From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Iowa Democratic Party says it will release more than half of the results, a majority, from last night's presidential caucuses at 5 o'clock Eastern Time today. Officials are blaming last night's lack of results on a coding error in their new app. They say that app was collecting results accurately but only partially reporting them. That still leaves a lot of questions about the app and the caucuses. Nevada Democrats have announced they'll not use the app for their caucuses coming up. And some are predicting the death of the Iowa caucuses altogether, or at least the accepted notion that Iowa voters have to go first. A short time ago, we spoke with Kay Henderson, news director of Radio Iowa. We've been speaking with her for years and asked her what else officials were talking about.
Well, the interesting development this morning is that Iowa's top Republicans, the governor and two U.S. senators, have issued a statement in unison sort of supporting the Democratic Party and taking a pause and making sure that these results are accurate. Senator Chuck Grassley spoke by phone with Iowa reporters today and said unequivocally that 2024 Iowa Republicans will hold caucuses first in the country. They're sort of laying the groundwork for their argument, which could lead to something we've never seen in this country. Republicans nationally have some sort of nominating schedule, and Democrats might have a different one. Wouldn't that be interesting?
Well, yeah, and we remember that Republicans had problems in the Iowa caucuses. I think it was 2012. So, you know, there have been issues before, but talk about this one, starting a brand new system with
right.
a brand new way of voting, by the way. There was a different form of caucus. But why didn't they have some redundancy? Why didn't they keep the second system parallel, at least for the first time out?
You know, that's a question that I'm sure Democratic Party Chairman Troy Price at some point will face if he has a news conference.
Mm. And by the way, when we say use the old system, that's just, you know, people picking up phones and calling
right.
the paper count in and a hand count. I mean, it's very grassroots, which is what people love about it.
You know, and a word, there are a lot of disappointed local people who volunteered, spent hours preparing for this thing, and to have it blow up like this and give them a black eye is really disappointing to them because they spent a lot of time preparing for this.
Well, and, you know, when they did try to call in because the app didn't work, they couldn't get through to anybody. So all systems seem to fail. And everybody's indicating that it's not some outside force, which we have been worried about going into the elections. Nobody said they were hacked or anything. But it was an app that was developed by the Democratic Party. Lawrence Norden, an elections expert at NYU School of Law, said it's like a major retailer using new cash registers for the first time on Black Friday. What kind of a black eye is this for the Democratic Party?
Well, I guess we will determine that as the days and weeks unfold. But there had already been discussion among folks in the party nationally that Iowa shouldn't go first because of its demographics.
Right.
You had Julian Castro making that argument in the last month of his campaign for the presidency. And you have people on the Democratic National Committee who may think that's a message that may have to be addressed within the party.
Well, and one can only imagine that different candidates have different reasons to want these results out. And, you know, that there may be lawsuits to try to keep them from coming out, because the whole point of the Iowa caucuses is that they act as this catapult to New Hampshire. And now that momentum has kind of been shifted. There are different candidates, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, claiming victories. Joe Biden didn't have a good night last night. So what is your sense of what Iowa means right now in this election?
Well, it will be fascinating when these results come out and these candidates are confronted with it in New Hampshire as they're trying to convince voters in that primary state that they have made some sort of mark in Iowa. So this is just a developing story, and it seems to, you know, change every hour as we advance.
But do the candidates who are claiming that they did well, Pete Buttigieg comes to mind, they say it's because they have people on the ground counting. And we all watched on television, those of us who couldn't be there, could see people counting as they went to their corners to caucus
right.
stand.
Right, so at every one of these precincts, there was a person on behalf of the campaign who was a captain telling us what their people were reporting from each of these precincts.
Well, and then if for some reason when the numbers come out, they're wrong, I mean, it could just be a mess, I guess.
Exactly.
That's Kay Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa, longtime voice of the Iowa caucuses. Kay, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, as the Democratic presidential candidates stream into New Hampshire, some are putting their spin on how they did in Iowa last night. Here's Elizabeth Warren apparently referring to Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg.
Here's what we know. It's a tight three-way race at the top. We know that the three of us will be dividing up most of the delegates coming out of Iowa. I'm feeling good.
Joining us now is Josh Rogers, who covers politics for New Hampshire Public Radio. Hi, Josh.
Good to be here.
So today marks the beginning of what is expected to be a frantic week of campaigning.
Yes.
But of course, the big question is what the lack of the complete results in Iowa will mean for candidates in New Hampshire.
You know, a lot of this is going to be about perception until the results come in. You know, New Hampshire rarely follows Iowa in lockstep. It's actually, I think it's been 16 years since the same Democrat carried Iowa and New Hampshire, who wasn't an incumbent. That was John Kerry. You know, Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, and Elizabeth Warren have all been polling pretty strong in New Hampshire. Sanders, the strongest. I think he's led pretty much every poll taken this year. And obviously, he carried the state almost 2-1 over Hillary Clinton. But, you know, a lot can change. And, you know, obviously, Buttigieg and others, Klobuchar last night when she took the stage in Iowa,
yep,
said, you know, it's clear we're punching above our weight. And, you know, it's elections are about results and also the perceptions about results. So once we get the results, it'll be easier to see how successful candidates will be in crafting the perception. But, you know, voters here are bracing themselves for what's going to be a busy week.
Let's talk a little bit about Joe Biden. Limited results from Iowa show that he is not the top candidate, at least for now. Here he was in Iowa last night.
More indication is going to be close. We're going to walk out of here with our share of delegates. We don't know exactly what it is yet, but we feel good about where we are. And look, so it's on to New Hampshire.
You mentioned, Josh, that Biden has been polling strong in New Hampshire. Is it a must win for him?
Well, I guess we'll see what happens out of Iowa. I mean, the indications were that he was certainly not in the top two or three candidates. His campaign has long been based on, you know, kind of a national vision and being strong in the South and some of the later voting states. You know, in New Hampshire, he has pulled relatively strongly. He certainly is well known. He has a lot of older political members of the establishment supporting him. But you go to Biden events and you find lots of voters who say they like Joe Biden. They like the idea of Joe Biden, but they're often also quick to turn and say they have doubts about, you know, Joe Biden's capacity to do the job as well as he might. And, you know, a weak result in Iowa could mean bad things for him here.
Yeah. You mentioned Bernie Sanders showing strength there in New Hampshire. I'm also thinking about Elizabeth Warren and her numbers there. But at this point, it's looking like Sanders, as you mentioned, will do pretty well there. Can you explain more about the sentiment and the support for Sanders?
Well, I think it's hard to underestimate the fact that Bernie Sanders did so well 4 years ago. And while Elizabeth Warren in the fall really seemed to be gaining ground and, you know, colleagues of mine did reporting on voters who had voted for Sanders 4 years ago, but who were really leaning Warren this time. And, you know, that seems to have reversed. You know, a lot of the Sanders people are much more diehard in terms of kind of it's Sanders or no one anecdotally that you talk to when you go to Sanders events. You know, we'll see a lot of the party and its platform has kind of drifted in Sanders' direction from 4 years ago. And a lot of young voters are particularly excited by Sanders, although, you know, again, it's very fluid situation and
yeah,
Elizabeth Warren could still run quite strong here.
Yeah. Can we talk very quickly about some of the other contenders? You mentioned Amy Klobuchar. She had that line about how she's punching above her weight. Is that true in New Hampshire? I'm also thinking about Andrew Yang, Tulsi Gabbard, who actually moved to New Hampshire.
Yes.
And has staked everything on her results there. And then Tom Steyer, who we don't talk a lot about, but I just wonder about his
standing there as
well.
But he lives in every mailbox in New Hampshire. I mean, the amount of campaign mail that he's dropped in the state is vast. And you know, you don't find many hardcore Steyer supporters out there among the voters when you go to events. But you do find a lot of people who, you know, say they're potentially open for voting for somebody other than the candidate they're mostly predisposed towards. And, you know, Amy Klobuchar is someone who, you know, maybe she does need a strong result in Iowa to build momentum, but she's an interesting case in that she's done what you are allegedly supposed to do to win New Hampshire. She's built connections over the years with local politicians. She's sort of centrist, incremental, trying to work with independents and reaching out to moderate Republicans. So it'll be interesting to watch for her. And, you know, Tulsi Gabbard and Andrew Yang are both interesting in the coalitions that they've built. You know, I'm not expecting either one of them to, you know, make huge gains here. But, you know, again, it's wide open. We'll see. But one thing I'm keeping an eye on is where they might pull support from. Does it does it get pulled out of Sanders's pile or elsewhere?
Yep. That's Josh Rogers. He covers politics for New Hampshire Public Radio. Josh, thank you.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
You probably know of Bill Kristol, not the comedian, the neoconservative, liberal-turned-conservative, who's been a leading critic of President Trump, who's returned the favor. Well, this past weekend, after Republicans refused to vote for witnesses in the impeachment trial, Kristol tweeted out, "Not presumably forever, not perhaps for a day after November 3rd, 2020, not on every issue or in every way until then, but we are all Democrats now." Really? He served in Republican administrations, founded the conservative Weekly Standard, was a fierce supporter of the war in Iraq, an opponent of Bill Clinton's health reform, is now editor-at-large of the conservative site The Bulwark, and chair of the new Project for the Republican Future. A Democrat? Bill Kristol joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that until November 3rd, 2020, at the presidential level at least, the attempt, which I was involved in, to recruit a strong Republican challenger to Donald Trump has failed. So if you want to replace Trump as president, it's going to be by a Democrat.
What was the tipping point for you? Was it Senator Lamar Alexander, for instance, calling out the president's actions in Ukraine, as you write in The Bulwark, saying they were wrong, but then saying he's not going to vote for witnesses or conviction?
I think I had a series of sort of mini tipping points, which added up to one big one. I mean, Trump turned out to have such a stranglehold on the party. And we saw that in the House on the impeachment vote, where, again, I thought, OK, they're mostly going to stick with Trump. But 10 or 20, I think, would desert. And as happened with Nixon, didn't happen. Then in the Senate, well, thought, OK, you know, there are people who are retiring, who have pretty distinguished careers. Do they want to go down with this ship? And the fact that they're all rationalizing now a vote to acquit, pretty hard for me to look anyone in the eye, honestly, and say, hey, let's join me in the fight to save the soul of the Republican Party. So the combination of what's happened in the country in terms of there being no credible challenger to Trump and what's happened with the congressional Republicans, especially on impeachment, but not only on impeachment, incidentally, the general justification of Trump and the acceptance of Trumpism is almost as bad as the acceptance of Trump, the kind of degeneration of everyone's rhetoric into Trump-like rhetoric.
Well, you have called him in your different writings loathsome, a con man, a charlatan, a demagogue, someone soiling the robe of conservatism. But I presume you see all the headlines laying the blame for all of this right at your feet. Here's one. Jacob Weisberg and Slate, who killed the responsible Republican? Bill Kristol, of course, is that headline. And he referred to when Bill Clinton was trying to pass universal health care in 1993. You wrote several kind of scorched earth memos telling Republicans not to work with Democrats on any social or economic legislation. Some people point to that and say, you're the one who started this, this idea that Republicans who were known for working good government should no longer cooperate with another party.
I mean, at times I've been tactically certainly against cooperation and who hasn't been in politics, and maybe at some of those times I was wrong. But I think I have a pretty good record in foreign policy especially, and including under President Obama, of trying to find times to support Democratic presidents when they did the right thing. We supported Bill Clinton in Bosnia. We supported the surge in Afghanistan, though I had my doubts about how serious President Obama was in carrying through and so forth. So I think on those kinds of issues, I've tried not to be simply a scorched earth opponent. There are times I went further than I should have, I now think in retrospect. But I don't think I've ever descended to the kind of level of personal invective that Trump routinely does.
Well, but as you know, we have the New Yorker's Benjamin Wallace Wells, who wrote in 2018 that your political views, shaped by the end of the Cold War, a generation that thought the country could handle populism, a conservative turn on immigration without succumbing to nativism or demagoguery, but it did. Then there's John Schwartz in the
Intercept. Well, but let me just interrupt
on
that.
All right.
I mean, what is the alternative? To say that there's no position that can accommodate anyone's concerns on any populist issue, and that if you were for – I mean, I actually am quite liberal on immigration. But I do think being able to say that there are some problems with, you know, unrestricted immigration isn't a crazy thing to say. But it's really important then to draw the line at nativism and xenophobia and bigotry. And I've tried pretty hard to draw that line.
Yeah. Well, you have. But I guess the writing that I'm referring to now isn't as much about what you did, but what you might have set the stage for unwittingly. And that brings us to Jonathan Schwartz in The Intercept. Who writes, I mean, this is going to be in the Wayback Machine for a lot of people, but some of us remember, post-Watergate, there was a feeling among some conservatives that no Republican would ever be forced from office again, despite, you know, how Nixon's sins were indefensible. It was Republicans who told him to step down. It was a largely Republican-appointed Supreme Court who decided he had to turn over his damning and, frankly, crude tapes. But there was another group that agreed when Nixon said, we need to create a new establishment. Some pledged they would construct a system of conservative media led by Fox. They'd have carefully picked judges to ensure no president would get impeached. Foundations that supported people like you and your father before you. And Jonathan Schwartz goes on to write that now, like a small amount of bacteria exploding exponentially on a patient with a weakened immune system, this conservative counter-establishment has taken over the host organ and become the establishment. I mean, do you agree with that view that this stage was set 30 years ago for this?
Ludicrous. I was 21 years old when Nixon was impeached, and I was on the side of impeaching him, so I don't know what I had to do with that. But no, the conservative counter-establishment was mostly a healthy counter-establishment, unless the left's view is that there should be no one on the other side. You want a conservative counter-establishment. You don't want a bigoted, xenophobic conservatism. Maybe we haven't done as good a job as we might have in fighting that at every stage, but we've certainly tried to. You know, I was for kicking Pat Buchanan out of the Republican Party.
Yep.
I said I would not support Ron Paul in 2008 or 2012 if he won the Republican nomination.
But you were right that you broke, for instance, with Roger Ailes. But before that, you worked with Roger Ailes to build an empire that frankly spreads disinformation. And now you have a Republican base that won't even look at outlets like the Washington Post or CNN that you appear in and on. You have said that maybe the party didn't do enough to fight this demagoguery and this division that has kind of brought us to this place that you hate right now with Donald Trump.
No, I think that's a fair criticism. I just think one has to go through and say what exactly could have been done at different stages. And there's some tough judgment calls. I wrote for the New York Times in 2008. So I'm not one who has tried to just stay in the conservative ghetto. The Weekly Standard was a magazine that had an awful lot of liberal readers and tried to make arguments to liberals and published some liberals. And certainly on the cultural side was much more eclectic. So I'm not – look, I made mistakes. But on the whole, unless you want to take the position, which some people do on the left, that the entire conservative movement for 50, 60 years, that was all illegitimate. Mm-hmm. All of that was just a precursor to Donald Trump. Unless you want to take that position, I think you have to say that there's a respectable conservatism. There's a degenerate form of conservatism. Some of us might have drawn the line at slightly different places of where that was. I mean, I feel comfortable, I guess I would say, and I feel even proud of having worked for Reagan and George H.W. Bush and having opposed Buchanan and having opposed various forms of bigotry in the Republican Party.
Yeah. And again, we're not talking about some of those things you mentioned. We are talking about the building of this infrastructure that's been the springboard for disinformation and for divisiveness that have somehow led to this place that we are, that you have expressed your unhappiness with. Where does it go from here, Bill Kristol? I mean, where do you see the Republican Party going?
Nowhere good in the next during 2020. And then the question is, can it be saved afterwards? Trump has to be defeated. even then, I think I'm much more pessimistic than I was a couple of years ago that it would be easy or even maybe possible to get beyond Trump. So I am genuinely open-minded about where I would be. Maybe we'll end up with three parties. Maybe we'll all become Scoop Jackson Democrats again. That's what I started off as in the 70s. And I don't mean that in a flip way. I think it's a new moment. It would be foolish not to rethink things. I'm trying to rethink some conservative orthodoxies. I think a lot of intelligent people on the left are rethinking some liberal orthodoxies. And so I'm very honestly just agnostic about what the future looks like. I do think in the short term, I think a second term of Donald Trump is very dangerous.
Last quick question. Can the Republican Party be rebuilt, repaired, without deconstructing some of this infrastructure we just talked about? Not, of course, losing media outlets that might have a more conservative bent, but those that disseminate lies. I don't know how that happens. But
well, that's the question, yeah, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's a free country. And so I left Fox, but I can't shut down Fox. And I don't think we want a country where that would be easy to do. The Weekly Standard, the magazine I edited, basically was closed down by its owners because we were anti-Trump. So I don't think the problem is really the infrastructure at this point. The problem is Trump. The Trump problem is the base, which has become infected with a kind of xenophobia and authoritarianism. And I will say this, the degree to which elite conservatives, though, have accommodated and rationalized Trump is very bad. So Fox News, they were not as crazy or as conspiratorial, certainly 10 years ago, 15 years ago, as they are today. They were just conservative mostly with a sort of some Bill O'Reilly-type populism that was mostly rhetorical and semi-harmless, I would say, and certainly didn't have the kind of Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham edge of real bigotry, I don't think. But the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which was a very respectable page, the degree to which it, for example, has rationalized conspiracy theorizing and Trumpism, that has been a bit of a shock for me. And so I don't disagree with what I think is kind of underlying some of your questions, which is that conservatism as a whole has more rethinking to do than just getting rid of Trump. The conservative elites have turned out to be much more susceptible to the appeal of a winning demagogue, much more driven by just hatred of the left than by affection for certain principles and a certain vision of the country. And that's been that has been a little startling to me and a little distressing to me and something we need to confront, I think.
Bill Kristol, editor-at-large of the conservative news and opinion website The Bulwark, thank you so much for coming. Look forward to speaking to you again.
Yeah, I do too. Thanks.
By the way, Bill Kristol has said he made a mistake in pushing Sarah Palin for VP, still believes the Iraq War was right, and as we heard, for now is a Democrat. Let's check back in Iowa, where a malfunction in a new smartphone app has thrown the Iowa caucuses into disarray. Most results will be out later at 5 Eastern time, but state Democratic officials are trying to reassure campaigns that those results were not compromised. Darrell Brackeen was a precinct captain in Marion, Iowa. He's a supporter of Joe Biden. He traveled from Connecticut to make sure other Biden supporters showed up and then gathered in Biden's corner of a room. And Darrell, we know how much hard work this is for volunteers like you. How are you feeling today?
Yeah, actually, I'm feeling great, energized, kind of losing my voice. It was very active and a lot of fun.
Wait, you're feeling great? There's no catapult. There's no momentum coming out of Iowa for Joe Biden or for anybody.
Yeah, well, this is the long-term plan that Joe Biden has been setting out for months at this point. This is just the beginning. It's not the end.
Darrell, I'm sorry. Most of the country's in meltdown because the Iowa caucuses didn't work. I mean, it's not just walking into a booth and voting. It's a very interactive thing. It's been under attack because people feel the Iowa caucuses are too time consuming. People with children can't go, or it's not a swath of a diverse America. So they've already been under attack. And now this, aren't there people there who are disheartened by this?
Well, of course, the local Iowans are absolutely disheartened. And look, the Iowa Democratic Party, they have a lot to explain. But on the ground, being here on the ground, having organized, it was a great participation. Mm-hmm. We actually ended up coming out a better community.
There is that. But your candidate, Joe Biden, did not rally people last night. He didn't have a good night. Pete Buttigieg, Sanders did. Buttigieg is claiming a huge victory based on the captain count. Do you think your candidate is not doing enough to claim a victory out of Iowa?
Well, we can't claim a victory without actually having the results. And we're waiting on the Democratic Party to give that official results.
Mm. Okay, well, how do you feel your candidate did from what you, the corner you looked in?
Right, and you know, which was a very small corner. You know, we organized, it was about 116 caucus goers in my site in particular, and there were only three delegates at stake. And essentially, those three delegates were split between Biden, Sanders, and Warren.
So, and so you're saying that the prize at the end of the night was three delegates. Those were the campaigns that split those three delegates. How many people showed for Biden?
There were 37.
37 out of 100 and something. That's not bad. What was the top number in the room?
Elizabeth Warren was 21, and Bernie Sanders took the cake. I believe it was around 50, 60 or so much.
Oh, boy. Is that unsettling to you?
Well, we knew it was going to be competitive from the beginning. As you can see, the polls even indicated that. But it's just very consistent with what we already knew.
Daryl, as you know, President Trump is pointing to this as the failure of the Democratic Party to run anything. As we said, people are pointing to this as the reason that the Iowa caucuses have to go away. You're somebody who worked so hard on this. You say what?
Well, I come from a primary state in New Haven, Connecticut. So I'm absolutely used to the primary process, this caucus process. You know, it's about over 50 years old. And, you know, we are entering in the 21st century. I know the party did its best to update the process, but I don't know that this is probably the best way forward, personally.
Yeah. Daryl Brackeen, volunteer precinct captain last night at the Iowa caucuses. As he said, he came from Connecticut to support Joe Biden. Daryl, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
President Trump will deliver his third State of the Union address tonight, in which he is expected to tout his achievements. And this speech comes on the eve of the final vote of the Senate impeachment trial, which will determine if Trump will be removed from office. For more on tonight's State of the Union address, let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. And Franco, what achievements is the president likely to highlight in his address tonight?
Well, a senior administration official told us that the president's going to lay out a vision of, quote, relentless optimism. The theme is the great American comeback. And he's going to highlight the economy. He's also going to invite, you know, Congress to join him on issues like immigration and lowering drug prices. But, you know, as we know, it's a tall order considering the deep divisions today.
Yeah. You know, I think everyone's wondering if he's expected to mention impeachment and really use this opportunity to smear the Senate trial.
Well, I can tell you that some Republican senators are certainly hoping that he does not. Mm-hmm. But Mark Short, who's the chief of staff for the vice president, said today that the president may highlight, you know, how inside the Beltway everyone is so focused on impeachment while other issues that Americans care about are not being discussed.
Yeah, you know, President Trump isn't the first president to deliver a State of the Union address amid an impeachment trial. President Clinton did so, right, in 1999?
Yes, he did. He had that same similar cloud. It was during the Senate trial. Clinton did not mention impeachment once. So there is some precedent for not mentioning impeachment. But I will say that a White House official told me that Trump's unlikely to hold back if he feels like he does need to take a shot at the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Tonight's address also comes, of course, one day after the Iowa caucuses, where, of course, Trump gained overwhelming Republican support. And the Democratic caucuses, as we're learning, was definitely a mess thanks to these issues around the use of this new app. I mean, Trump has already mocked the Democrats about this on Twitter. Do you think he'll throw more political jabs at them?
Well, I mean, the White House is arguing that this will be an optimistic speech. But, you know, Mark Short, again, kind of talked a little bit about this. He wouldn't say whether Trump would actually throw specific jabs at Democrats, but he did say that the situation in Iowa, you know, kind of shows that the party is in chaos and it will give the president an opportunity to kind of tell more of his story. You know, and President Trump is also expected to draw kind of a sharp contrast between himself and some of the Democratic candidates on key issues, particularly the health care plan.
Mm-hmm. The Democratic rebuttal will be delivered by not one but two women. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer will speak in English and Texas Congresswoman Veronica Escobar in Spanish. Tell us a little bit more about who they are and what we're expected to hear from them.
So Whitmer has been the governor for just over a year. You know, she's from Michigan, an important swing state, you know, that Trump won by a tiny margin. But it was the first time that a GOP candidate had won the state, you know, since 1998. You know, not only does her pick represent how important Michigan will play in the key election, in the presidential election, but she is also an example for Democrats that a Democrat can win in the Midwest. She's likely to talk about some of the issues that she ran on, you know, infrastructure, kitchen table issues, roads, infrastructure, clean water, and climate change. Then Veronica Escobar, she's going to give the Spanish language rebuttal, as you said. You know, she is a vocal critic of the Trump administration, particularly on immigration issues. She's been calling for changes on immigration policies, increased oversight on border enforcement agencies. You can expect that she'll highlight those issues when it's her turn.
Who are some of the other guests who will be attending tonight?
So the president is going to bring the deputy chief of the Border Patrol, Raul Ortiz. He was recently promoted to the deputy chief position. He also in the past served as an agent in the San Diego and Del Rio area. Prior to that, he was in the Army. President Trump is also bringing Tony Rankins. He is an Army veteran who suffered from PTSD and drug addiction. He's also struggled with homelessness and now lives in one of the opportunity zones that the administration has been working on in Cincinnati, Ohio. There's going to be other guests. You know, members obviously will have their guests as well. Some of those include Courtney Wilde, who testified in the Jeffrey Epstein case. She said that, you know, Jeffrey Epstein sexually abused her. She'll be a guest of Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Speier of California. And also there's going to be the fiance of Jamal Khashoggi. She is going to be the guest of Democratic Congresswoman Jerry Connolly of Virginia. Khashoggi, as we know, was the Saudi dissident writer who wrote columns for the Washington Post and was killed in the Saudi consulate.
Well, we'll definitely all be watching. Thank you so much. That's NPR's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, as the Senate prepares to vote on the two articles of impeachment tomorrow, many people around the country, including voters in South Central Pennsylvania, have been keeping tabs on the hearings. The region is largely moderate in a swing state that will be closely watched this election season. As WITF's Katie Meyer reports, many of those in Pennsylvania from both sides of the aisle say throughout the impeachment process, they resigned themselves to partisan divisions.
On an unseasonably warm Monday afternoon, Beverly and Bob Niebuhr are in the parking lot of a Home Depot in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. The couple's truck is filled with lumber for a deck they're building with their granddaughter. Beverly voted for Donald Trump in 2016. She says her husband has been tied to the impeachment hearings, but she feels differently.
For days, he listened to this impeachment trial, and I said, it's just a big waste of money. Nothing is going to be done.
Beverly considers herself a Republican and her husband Bob is an avowed Democrat, but neither fits squarely into either party's mold. She says sometimes more government spending is warranted, for instance, to give veterans better services. Bob, meanwhile, appreciates Trump's economic policies and doesn't mind his border tightening efforts, but he doesn't trust Trump to tell the truth and thinks a lack of accuracy affected the impeachment process, too.
They should have called witnesses. He withheld appropriated funds for his self-betterment.
The Nieberts say they mostly steer clear of impeachment talk at home. Both of them have had their minds made up about the trial. And Bob says he thinks that's been the case everywhere.
It was purely whether you're a Republican or a Democrat the way you saw it.
At a bus stop in downtown Harrisburg, Tyree Alston says that's true for her, too. She says she never liked the president, didn't vote for him, and doesn't think it's fair that Senate Republicans will likely acquit him.
I don't agree with Donald Trump being in office anymore. Just watching him on Twitter talking about everything else but what's happened, I just don't feel like his focus is right.
Alston considers herself a Democrat, as does Sahir Marion. He's been watching the impeachment process with frustration.
I don't think it's fair, but it's been like that for years. So therefore, you know, what can you do? There's nothing you can do. Everybody's hands are tied, and we just got to fight through it.
About 10 minutes outside Harrisburg, in the borough of Camp Hill, Pauline Gutschall and her husband, a retired couple, are about to do their weekly grocery shopping. Gutschall says her opinion on Trump and impeachment hasn't shifted since the hearings began. She thinks the Democrats who control the House are out of line.
I think he's been a very good president for us. I think he has done a lot of things for this country. And I think they're wrong. I think they're just witch hunting.
Another shopper, Daniel Shankin, is the father of two young children and a Democrat. He says even though he's never supported Donald Trump politically, he's tried to be cautious when it comes to sweeping conclusions about impeachment.
I don't want to get wrapped up in the divisiveness of the political climate. I feel that if the Republicans feel this strongly and there is nothing illegal about the process, that they're well within their rights and they should be able to exercise them.
And he says despite the obvious partisan divide in American politics, he's holding out hope that after it's all over, compromise will be possible.
We can all weather this. The end of the world is not coming because of this.
Trump's approval ratings have remained relatively steady in Pennsylvania since the impeachment trial began, on average hovering around the mid-40s. The president won Pennsylvania by less than a percentage point in 2016, and the state will be closely watched as the election season continues. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
We didn't have time yesterday to talk about one of the most important news stories of the day. The Super Bowl ads, Bill Murray grabbing a groundhog to reprise his role in Groundhog Day, this time loving the daily do-overs in a new Jeep.
That's different.
Good job.
Hey! He's got the groundhog!
Or Sam Elliott squaring off with Lil Nas X on a literal Old Town Road for Doritos.
Can nobody tell me nothing? You can't tell me nothing.
And then an elderly man storing his memories of his late wife, Loretta, with Google. That brought a few tears.
Show me photos from our anniversary. Remember, she always snorted when she laughed.
I tweeted out that I love that ad, and then my feed exploded. You idiot, he's losing his privacy. Really? Let's bring in Ryan Mack, senior technology reporter for BuzzFeed News. Hi, Ryan.
How's it going?
It's good, but your thoughts on what this is, because we should say that all you can see in the ad is the screen and, you know, Google responding when the letter's coming up to this elderly man. He's asking them to display their anniversary photos, but this Google service is also telling him to remember things. It shoots out a list of things to remember about Loretta. What is this?
So this is just the Google Assistant. You can find it on your Google Home speaker or Android phones, pretty much any Google device. It's the voice-activated assistant that comes up when you say, hey, Google, on your device.
Right. And so what can you ask it to do?
You can ask for a number of things. I mean, there's all types of features built into it. What's the weather like? What are the movies playing in my city? And in this ad, it looked like it was helping this old man kind of remember his late wife. And so there was this kind of remember feature that I've never used before, but it seemed like they were trying to use to kind of pull at the heartstrings.
Right. It seems like it goes Siri one further and that you could ask it to do things, but then it also had this sort of remember file. And I guess it could be anything from remember you wanted to pick up your child at 2 o'clock, or remember that Loretta likes pink. That's one of the things that the elderly man had. And of course, people were reacting in my Twitter feed to this notion that this was a privacy issue. Your thoughts on that?
I think people have just kind of woken up to this idea that these technology companies are just collecting mountains of information on people. Had this ad run 2 or 3 years ago, I don't know if you'd have kind of seen that same reaction. But these days, I mean, with the amount of privacy issues at companies like Facebook, for example, Google and Amazon, you're starting to see this kind of backlash to even the kind of most heartfelt commercials, I guess.
Right. Well, Kashana Kali tweeted out, really loving the lighthearted Google commercial about how Google knows everything we've ever done. You tweeted, that Google ad was great, except they left out the part where they tell you that they'll use grandma's favorite things to target ads at grandpa and the rest of the family. But we all know that, right? We all know that all of our information is being used by Google to target us for different kinds of advertising. What I tweeted out was, okay, so maybe we need to monitor the use of a memory bank like this. But really, what's wrong with Google knowing on some level that Loretta likes pink?
I think a lot of people agree with you. I mean, there's nearly 50,000 likes on upvotes on YouTube. So I think most people probably did like it, but maybe should be more aware of the implications. I think to contest the point of does everyone know that they're doing these things, I don't know if people have been aware. When you hit search, when you say, hey, Google, that information can be used to then sell you something, I think is something that, I don't know, most people don't think about on a day-to-day basis.
Well, this was actually the grandfather of a Google employee. And in a blog post, Google's chief marketing officer wrote, "This ad reflects our goal to build products that help people in their daily lives in both big and small ways." You know, in my first, and I admit, kind of naive reaction to it was, what a great thing for someone who's obviously seems to be losing memories. I mean, it seemed, I thought at first it was going to be some sort of ad about Alzheimer's or, you know, losing your memory. Jeez, I mean, I guess you have to weigh everything. If this elderly person forgets and starts giving deeply personal family information to this memory bank, that would be another issue. You know, are you saying that, you know, maybe it should be monitored because it could be both a wonderful thing and a dangerous thing?
I think that's probably fair. I just don't know what and who would be doing the monitoring. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's very little regulation around what kind of data can be stored by these companies. And when we get to these kind of voice assistants, I think that's an even newer frontier. I mean, I think a lot of us have experiences of elder relatives who have trouble with technology. And while this kind of example, this commercial shows like a good use of it, I'm sure there's all kinds of difficult things or horror stories that we don't want to have happen. And I think it's them trying to tug at the heartstrings a little bit while kind of covering up some of the aspects of how it makes money.
Mm-hmm. Barb, beware. That's Ryan Mack, senior technology reporter for BuzzFeed News. Ryan, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, that ad, as he said, viewed over 5 million times. If you want to see it some more, we'll have it at herenow.org. We welcome your comments as well. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.